Hey, everybody. This is the Neil half of the Inform podcast. And before we get into the episode today, I wanted to make a very, very quick announcement. The episode you're about to hear is an interview that Jared and I did with Ryan Ingley from the Y3 podcast. We're super excited to present this to you. It was a lot of fun to talk to Ryan. However, I wanted to say that the topics we talk about, we didn't get into them as much as we would like to. We talked about ordinary psychosis and we talked about the psychoanalytic use of the classroom. And the conversation was good, but I had a class that I needed to teach, and so I was on a time crunch. And Ryan had a cat that he needed to take to the vet, so he was on a time crunch. And as a result, I think that while we covered those two topics somewhat, there's still a lot that we would like to say about both of them. And I just wanted to let everybody who hears this know that the podcast you're about to hear, the interview, it might seem a little bit rushed, but if you liked what was said here, please keep on downloading episodes of the Inform podcast because they're topics that we will be returning to in the future. Thanks, and here's the interview. All right, you are listening to an episode of the Inform podcast where we try to have informal conversations that are informative. My name's Neil. I'm joined by two people today. I have my regular co-host, the Cat's Meow of the podcasting world. Say hi, Jared.
Hi, Neil.
And we are also joined by a rock star of the psychoanalytic podcasting community, Ryan Ingley from Y Theory. We had Todd McGowan on an earlier episode, and Ryan has been really gracious with his time. He's going to come on today and talk with us about a couple of different topics. Ryan, where do you want to get started?
Yeah, well, first of all, hi. Thank you so much, Neil and Jared, for having me on. This is such a thrill. Like, I don't know if people know this, but when Todd and I started Y Theory, we didn't think anybody would listen. Todd had been asked to be on a number of different podcasts, and then he just called me and was like, do you want to do a podcast? And I said, sure, yeah, we can do that. And his only concern, this is very Todd, is that he just wanted to make sure that it could be funny. That was all that he cared about. He was like, but can it be funny? And I was like, I think it would be funny. I was like, I have fun talking to you. Don't you have fun talking to me? He was like, yeah. I was like, you make me laugh. I make you laugh. I was like, yeah. So we thought it would work. And it has been, man, it has been so great because a lot of, potentially a topic for a little bit later, but like a lot of doing this kind of work, especially in academia, can often feel like you're doing it in a void, or you're doing it in for a small but like fervent community. And it is, and I do think in some ways that's true, but it is through the process of doing this, like this podcast, and then like, you know, hearing from you guys that like you understand exactly how big this community actually is. And that's been really, really big, I think for me, and I know for Todd as well, because, you know, we've just been blown away by the response to the podcast that we didn't think anyone would listen to, and now doing this, so mm-hmm. This is super. So happy to be here, and very happy to talk.
It's funny, like if somebody were to ask me if my podcast was funny, I would think I would respond with something like, well, you can't see me, so no.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah. How did he phrase it? He didn't want it to be like, he wanted to make sure that that as much as it could be laugh at you funny, that like that it should be like you make someone laugh. That was his one requirement. Mm-hmm. And I thought that, so that was, anyway, that's a little peek behind the curtain.
That's on, awesome.
Yeah.
we've been emailing back and forth for a while. Mm-hmm. So let's, I'm going to try to catch up people maybe to the conversation that we've been having off mic here. So yeah. I initially emailed Ryan about like different things that would be kind of fun to talk about on our show, because on Y Theory, you take, you know, a very theoretical approach to mm-hmm. psychoanalysis, and you apply it to society and to films and to popular culture. Mm-hmm. And Jared and I are both people who are, you know, clinicians. And so we thought, like, wouldn't it be interesting to try to do something similar to that, but to try to come at it from a clinical angle, you know, and see how that worked out. And that's what we've been doing this time. It's interesting to me because I think you can't really talk about the clinical component without getting into the theory, you know, like
yeah.
that's impossible. I don't see, and people try to do it and it's crazy. I don't know why. But yeah, it's a praxis, a merging of practical doing stuff, making things happen, and abstract theoretical knowledge that you grapple to understand and all that.
Yeah. So
we've talked a lot about that. And then we talked, you and I were emailing back and forth about some of the movements in Lacanian theory over the course of it. And one of those movements being somewhere happening probably around like 72, I think, is when it really starts with Seminar 20, where Lacan starts to really move away from the structural clinic, you know, the clinic of foreclosure for psychosis and repression for neurosis and disavowal for perversion, and starts to move into a more Borromean framework where he starts to have this idea that we are all mad. And that what everybody does is they come up with their own unique way of dealing with the way that the real, the symbolic and the imaginary kind of like impact them as a subject.
Yeah.
And come up with a symptom or symptom, however different people say it.
Yeah. Symptom, I think. Yeah.
You know, to deal with it. And you seemed really interested in this topic. So why don't we start with what your interest in it is? We talked about Jacqueline Meller's ideas of ordinary psychosis. And if it's different from like just regular old psychosis. So take it away.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, man, there's so much in that. And I think like two things there are two spaces that we could maybe come back to in this conversation about where I think the analytic framework and the clinician's framework and the theoretical one overlap the most. And I do think it's in the classroom. And I think that it is actually with narrative, which is my, you know, one of my academic interests. There's this thing where, and you know, we can talk about it later, but like, right, where there's the analysis narrative. And then there's of course, like serial narrative, television narrative, all these kinds of things. And one of the things I find most fascinating is Freud in 1895 and studies on hysteria, that in talking about the experience of the clinic and in like where there are interruptions and problems, one of them is that the session has to end, and it ends on basically a cliffhanger. And he likens it to serial storytelling, to the to be continued. And I really, really love that. And so anyway, so that perhaps parked for later. So yeah, my interest in psychosis is a personal one, and it, I mentioned this in the podcast. I've talked about this like other places and try to be very open about this. When I start the semester and I introduce myself to students, I like to tell them that I'm a professor, a scholar with a cognitive and physical disability stemming from a car accident that I was in. It's really interesting, the conversation about car. The car did it to me. I don't know, but it's a single car accident. There's no one else involved. And I suffered a traumatic brain injury. If you put your own hand to your head and then you lift like your fingers up, about that much of my skull is fake. It's filled in with titanium wire mesh and bone substitute, which I like to think is like, that could be a dish at a dog's vegan restaurant. I don't know.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Bone substitute. Ooh. Yeah. It's very, very Cato, I think. And I was in a coma for 5 days. And, when I was taken out, which I, you know, I don't remember exactly that moment, but when I became conscious of what was going on, I had a really hard time adjusting to life. And I tried as hard as I could to not let anyone know. I was like, I'm just in the hospital, like, you know, half my skull is missing, half my head is shaved. I couldn't really hear out of my left ear because they didn't take all the blood out of it that had dried. Awful. And I was just like, so what happened to me? I was in a car accident. Oh, it hit a guardrail. Oh, it flipped. Hit a tree. Yeah. And I was, to me, that the easier thing to believe than that was that I had died. And I was just, like, I was very convinced that I was dead for about 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, going to therapy. I was getting better, and I would like, I'd see my parents and my friends. And I just, for whatever reason, I thought my friends were like they were kind of in on it or something. But my parents, I had this thing where like, they weren't really my parents. It was like people playing a role or something like that. And I never brought this up to anybody except for my friends, but I didn't bring it up to my parents because I thought I would have to go to therapy. And it wasn't just that, it was that like, I was convinced if I brought it up, if I gave voice to this at all, then like the literal walls that of any room would come crumbling down and I would die or something. Cause I like what I had thought was just some Jacob's Ladder scenario where in the moment that I died, I imagined the rest of my life where it would like to go like some way that I thought it should have gone or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I only ever brought it up to my friends. And I said to you before a show, when you're 19 and you say that you're pretty sure you're dead and everything's fake, they're just like, hell yeah, man. I fucking, yeah, of course. And it's like, so it's not really helpful, but that's what I needed. I didn't want, if someone had said to me like, you should talk to somebody about that, cause I don't think that's right. Like that's not the response that I needed. I needed people to like indulge me and allow me to continue to think that. And then, as I said to you before the show, I just had this like break where I was like, I'm probably not that smart. Like why am I that smart? Why do I have that kind of capacity to create an entire world filled with new stuff that didn't exist before you were in the car accident? All these movies were coming out that didn't exist, you know, and it's just like all this new stuff. There was so much new, and it was like, I can't be making that up. That is a profoundly selfish thing to think. And that was a really big deal. That took me a long time. So it was some alchemy of just like thinking that through and like my brain actually healing, like mm-hmm. led me to that position. But it is a thing that like every once in a while, I told you, if it's a calm, quiet night and the wind rustles in a certain way and it's 2 a.m. and it's just me and I'm playing video games, I can like sometimes be convinced like that, like, is this real? Did I really get a job in Southern California? Are you kidding me? Like, that's weird. How do I know? You know, and then I run through that thing and I have to like come back to a position of I don't know, or I have to come back to I don't know, perhaps a resting position where mm-hmm. all of it makes sense. But yeah, that's my personal interest in mm-hmm. In psychosis stemming from that event in my life.
How about you, Jared? You got anything that you wanted to say to that or other things about the Lacanian clinics, the move from structural to Borromean, anything like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll say something that came to mind while you were talking, Ryan. A couple months ago, I finished reading a book by Bruce Fink, and it's one of the extremely long titles by Bruce Fink. It's the Introduction to Lacanian Theory and Technique. One of those. He's got mm-hmm. like three titles that are extremely long. It's the older one of the three, I think. And in that one, he talks about the construction of a delusional metaphor when working with people that have psychosis. And so as you were talking, I was thinking about your friends telling you like, yeah, man, it's none of it's real. It's all a simulation. You know, actually, I'm going to take a brief aside. It's funny to listen to you say that and then also look at you on a green screen. Your office isn't actually behind you.
It's not behind me. Yeah, right, right.
So that's what crossed my mind as you were talking. Like your friend sort of stood in for this person helping to construct some sort of delusional metaphor that was like holding you together. It was acting as like a glue kind of for you.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And this is where like I love the idea of Santome, the symptom that the subject, you know, needs to have it be removed would be nothing less than to destroy the person, destroy the psyche, destroy the subject. I always think about this with I mentioned this on a podcast. Like I don't have them right now and it's making me feel very vulnerable. But when I teach, I always have mints in my pocket. It's like little tin of Altoids. This became, and this was before the car accident, I didn't give a crap. So I'd like whatever, like if I had gum or felt I had bad breath or whatever, I'd talk like with my mouth really closed so no one could really smell me or whatever, like, you know. But afterwards, I had to have mints on me all the time, and part of it, like, my jaw was broken, so I couldn't brush my teeth. So all I could do is like swish around, like in, when I was in the hospital, I could only swish around like medical Listerine, which doesn't have high alcohol content in it. And it would made my breath like stinky, sweet and awful, whatever. And so like because the car accident happened to my body, but in a meaningful way, it didn't happen to me. Like I have no memory of it. That what did happen to me while like in like my conscious, like working through was this, I couldn't brush my teeth and people came to see me and I had to talk to them. And it was like that, like almost like the most like banal kind of trauma within this schema. That was the thing that, that really got to me. So I had to have these mints. I had to have these mints on me. And I often think about the mints in like the keeping me together, but I hadn't thought about the role my friends played in giving me this delusional metaphor and allowing, like giving me this, like, this thing to, for me to relate to myself and to the world, to like almost like to re-enter it. Like that's fantastic. Yeah.
So I'm glad you thought so.
Yeah, no, it's great.
It's very cool. Yeah. As you were saying that, Ryan, there's two things that kind of came to mind for me. I'm mm-hmm. going to try to put them together into one sure. coherent thought. I don't know if I'll be able to do it. So, you know, the idea of ordinary psychosis is one of the things that we were emailing back and forth about, mm-hmm. which is this idea that Jacqueline Miller came up with, because he was supervising psychoanalysts and people would come in and they'd say like, I'm seeing this patient. They'd describe the patient and it'd be like, okay, let's do a differential diagnosis. Are they psychotic or are they neurotic? And the person would go, mm-hmm. I actually don't know. I'm not sure, because like they seem to have this weird kind of foreclosure going on, but it's not like they're having a complete psychotic break, mm-hmm. you know? And so there was this idea of a new diagnostic criteria, which Miller has resisted defining rigidly, right? He's just kind mm-hmm. of like gives a very vague description and says, you know, do something with it, use it in whatever mm-hmm. way works for you. It's this idea of ordinary psychosis. So when we were talking about the difference between what in like modern day psychoanalytic clinical groups we call like an ordinary psychotic versus a triggered psychotic. Mm. So an ordinary psychotic is somebody who, the way I think I described it, is somebody who believes in a law as opposed to the law.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And a triggered psychotic is somebody who does not believe in like that at all, right? Like they are, yeah. they have really lost touch. So the ordinary psychotic is still somewhat in touch with the symbolic order, right? Mm-hmm. But their version of the symbolic order, I would say, is different than, you know, the general version of the symbolic order, the way that they understand themselves as non-castrated, for example, mm-hmm. you know, comes mm-hmm. to mind. And so clinically, when you treat an ordinary psychotic, one of the things that's come up in discussions that I've been in with other clinicians is how do you react to this? Because the way you react to a neurotic is to intervene in their speech in ways that actively attempt to sort of disrupt their fundamental fantasy and mm-hmm. cut away the jouissance that they're deriving from engaging that fantasy in the way that they are. But when you do that with a psychotic, an ordinary psychotic, you might actually risk them having a full-on psychotic break. So in your scenario, you were believing those things and your friends in supporting you were actually performing the equivalent of a psychoanalytic intervention.
That is fantastic. Yeah, I love that so much. That's really great. I think that's absolutely right on. I think that and I think that I'm talking about this now from this position. So it seemed. So I don't want to make it sound like I had all this like meta awareness of it, like at the time, because obviously I didn't. Like I do now, but I did not then. But it was absolutely what I needed from them was to like to not say like, hey Ryan, that's like some scary shit.
Like that would make you more should. Crazy. You'd be like, they're in on it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Like they want the wall. Yeah, I gave you the I can't remember if I saw this movie before the car accident or after. I'm not really sure. Maybe it would have had to have been after. But the film was 1408, the John Cusack film based on Stephen King novel. This guy who is like a haunted house, a paranormal expert, goes to this hotel and he stays on this floor or in this room, 1408, supposed to be haunted. And the room messes with him. And at one point he thinks he's out and he's not, and he noticed his one thing wrong at a post office, and all these people just look at him, and with like sledgehammers, they destroy the post office, and like the it comes crashing down. He's back in the room, which is like hell. And I just thought like that was going to happen to me if I like truly faced this thing. And so, yeah, so all like all of this, I don't know, like I have, I don't know if you're like, I don't know if other people are like me. I've never actually asked anyone this question before, but like when something is like really, really true, it like hits you somewhere in like your body, anyway, everything that we're saying, like it's hitting me like in my chest, like a little bit above my stomach. Like that's like that is my like, this is true.
That's the speaking place. Body, man.
That's
the replacement of the Freudian unconscious with the speaking body right there. Yeah. You know, 'cause you do, you have a body event, as a result of those sorts of things. And they're significant. The other thing I was going to try to tie into that though, is, you know, Freud's work with Dora, that case study comes to mind. So what a lot of people, I think, don't know this about Freud, so I'm going to use this opportunity to say this. All of Freud's case studies that he wrote up were not therapeutic successes. They were like all the things that he
all
did
failures.
Wrong, right?
Yeah.
Because he was
very
transparent, I think, in the interest of helping people like learn how to do this thing called psychoanalysis and become more healthy more broadly and stuff, right? So...
And also I mean, he thought that just you learn more from failure than you do from a success.
Right.
Like, and that's like, man, well, so we're both in the academy. There are science journals that are about failed experiments and they receive no funding because that doesn't help anyone get tenure. And man, do I think those should be the biggest journals and they should, and there should be like, hey, I did or even just this, like in a humanities study, like, hey, I tried writing this article on this thing with this idea and it didn't work. Here's why. I think it is so much more pedagogical, but anyway, I'm sorry for interrupting, but
yeah, that's cool. That. What I was going to say is that what Freud did wrong in that case in the beginning, you know, Dora comes in and she's got a hysterical neurosis, what we might consider an ordinary psychosis today, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, he believes her, right? He's like, oh, so her K is doing this and she's doing what? Oh, okay. Sure. and it's only when he starts to interpret, you know, he starts to intervene from the position of like the name of the father or the one who knows or whatever other signifier we want to use, that he starts to mess up the case, because then he starts to challenge what he sees as her delusional metaphor. Right.
Yeah.
Her psychosis, her fantasy. And that's where it all falls apart. Right. And I think it's an excellent example of and Freud basically trying to challenge a psychotic structure and having that be a misstep, because it ended up kind of taking the psychotic structure and worsening it, not helping it much. And so when you're clinically, I think, engaging with people who've gone through what you've described, right, like a traumatic incident. That is literally a physical trauma that has created something that has changed the way that their brain is functioning, or if people have gone through some kind of like intense emotional or psychological trauma, you know, the intense grief kind of comes to mind. If you try to tell people any version of, but you know, that's not real, right?
Yeah, right.
What ends up happening is your intervention does not have the effect of helping a person come back to reality.
Yeah.
Of re kind of like indoctrinating them back into the symbolic order. It actually makes them further from it and makes them more psychotic. There was a kid who I worked with years and years ago who was convinced that the world was going to end in 2012. He really believed that. And I remember in the setting I worked with this kid, and it was a group home. So there was a lot of other people there. He wasn't like a patient like I see today. Mm-hmm. And so many people would try to talk him out of this. And every time they tried to talk him out of it, he would get more worked up. And he'd start insulting people and he'd say things that would get him in trouble. And I discovered that if I was just like, okay, you know what? I want to hear all about this. Talk to me about 2012. Let's hear it. Bring it on. And I'd ask questions, you know, okay, where did you read that? Okay, hold on a second. How does that relate to this? And in just doing that, he would tend to de-escalate. And become more calm, more reasonable, and ultimately not get himself into trouble. You know, now is that going to cure him? Did that cure him of his belief that the world was going to end in 2012? No, it didn't. But did it lead to him having an experience which was less activating in a traumatic way? I think it did, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's, and this is the, man, there's so many things here that I think are really fascinating that like, because psychoanalysis, like in this sense, like, I mean, what you're saying, it's about process. I would even say like, it's like narrative, process to pull it back to that thing. Like the something that I found really fascinating. Here's something for everybody. This is a Ryan Engley connection original. Narrative as a word, it comes from a Latin word narris, which means to know. So it's a verb. So a narrator is someone who knows, and that, as far as I know, nobody's really made this connection to like Lacan and the subject supposed to know, right? So narrative has this intrinsic connection to this idea of knowing, this idea of like of an authoritative figure. And I think, you know, as I said in the beginning, that like I like this as a point where theory and the clinic like really come together, is that like you are in the position of creating and like helping someone along in a narrative. And my friends helped me, right? They did not intrude in my narrative. Like they were fellow travelers with me. And like, eventually I was able to like, to heal and to find not, and this is the important thing, right? This is the psychoanalytic language. I was not cured, because as I said, every once in a while, like I have a slip perhaps for a fertile term. But what I had to move to was a different relation to that feeling that things were not real, to my ordinary psychosis. I had to, without those words and without that knowledge, I had to form a different relation to that. And it's really interesting in the case that you describe, is that like everybody else wanted to be someone who knew. They wanted to be the subject supposed to knew. They wanted to be the narrator for this kid. Like, you, that's not real. They wanted to be Ron Howard in Arrested Development and give the, like, you know, the objective truth of the situation. And that's not what he needed, you know, like, so anyway, so that example I find of that resonates a lot with me, and like one has to be careful of how you want to position yourself in someone else's narrative. And like it is, you know, like you cannot be to try to be the master of it, right? So that they can just do something else. I don't think so. Like I think that's maybe a fundamental misstep.
Got to be that small letter A.
Yes, exactly. That's right. The great line from Joan Kopchak, to be an object A ontologist, not an object or anyway, but yes, that's right. Yeah. Small object A. That's fascinating. Really interesting for me to think about that together, because I do think that threads, it quilts a lot of different ideas.
Mm-hmm. Jared, it looks like you wanted to chime in on there on something.
Yeah, I thought it was so funny that you mentioned Ron Howard in Arrested Development, because as you were talking before you said that, I made myself a note. I didn't want to forget this. I wrote Arrested Development bad narrator joke, and I don't know exactly where I wanted to go with it, but I wanted to say it and see what it did for you. I don't know. Maybe I should like paint a better picture of the one that I'm talking about.
Sure.
The narrator is talking about a different narrator of a TV show that Tobias acts in. And the narrator's talking about all these details that the fake narrator got wrong and all this stuff.
Just real like crap.
Exactly. Just real shoddy narration. Something like that. He says a bunch of stuff like that. So I don't know. That's what was running through my head as you were talking. And I also thought it was really funny that you then mentioned Arrested Development, like as soon as I finished writing that note.
Well, like, what is that moment? Except like, it's, I don't know. Arrested Development like is really great for being like a self-conscious, like comedy, but that's like, well, and I don't know if you know this, but like in the actual production of the show, he was just supposed to be in the first episode, and then there was not going to be a narrator for the rest of the show.
I did not know that.
Yeah. That's something I read somewhere. It was just supposed to be this like thing in the pilot episode that and then they had him in obviously in every episode, and then they had him on the show in the Netflix season. And I think that's like within a television narrative, it's like you invite the idea of the way to confirm the consistency of the narrator you're listening to is to like dump on like the potential, like to own the format and acknowledge it, but like also to that props up your own place. It's like, so there's a television term it's called, you put a lampshade on it. I don't, you hang a lampshade, like it, you acknowledge the thing that you're doing in a way not to like, almost to like escape criticism of the thing, but perhaps in some cases, but it just to allow you to continue to do the thing that you're doing. It's like, I think about, was it Umberto Eco had this take on Mikhail Bakhtin's like notion of Saturnalia, that like that he thought of this like the these events where hierarchy was suspended as being like truly you know, like where the kings would mix with the peasant people and in these big, you know, events, and like that they were these really great examples again where hierarchy is suspended in the older like Middle Ages like world. And Eco is reading this and is like, it doesn't do that. It makes it more like, cause then they go back to that structure. So like this moment that where you think that hierarchy is suspended is actually the moment where it becomes like more firm. And I think that's that'd be my immediate gloss on like the utility of that particular moment in Arrested Development. What it does for Ron Howard is like, if there is any, like, again, maybe it goes back to the fact that they plan the show for him not to be a part of it. So this is a way to like affirm that, like, nope, this is it. Like, this is how we're doing it. Like, this is good. This is what good narration, like it almost allows you, without saying there are bad ways of doing narrative and there are good, like you don't have to literally say that, but you kind of demonstrate your commitment to doing like the good narrative, which is to like to interject and to give the you know, that's I think what the Ron Howard narrator is known most for. Like when Lindsay says, you know, it's not like children aren't born with a they don't come with a handbook. And then he says, there are actually several thousand books on child rearing and like, you know, that kind of thing. So he's always there as, I think, something that in the liberal imagination we want, which is this like constant fact checker, right? Mm-hmm. Like to just insert itself and give the, like the authoritative like imprint on. I think that would be my take.
As you guys are saying this, what kind of comes to my mind again here is, you know, like when a patient comes in for psychotherapy or for psychoanalysis, they talk about their life, right? They narrate what's going on. This is my narrative. This is my story. This is what I'm living through. This is my problem. This is why I'm here. There's all sorts of different ways they might set it up, but that's what they do. And I think one of the fundamental differences that exists between psychotherapy, as it's generally practiced, and psychoanalysis is that a psychotherapist sort of, in many ways, I think, accepts the transference and tries to be the big other for the patient. In that group home that I was at, I think everybody wanted to be the big other for the kid who believed the world would end in 2012.
Yeah.
The psychoanalytic way of dealing with that is to not be the big other. To in a sense, like, I mean, the person can try to cast you in that S1 kind of category. But what you do is you keep yourself in the analytic discourse. You remain small letter A, object A, and you don't accept the authority in a sense, right? You consistently say you are the authority on your narrative. Mm-hmm. This is your narrative. Well, why don't you tell me more about that?
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's like... when I talk about, I like quilting point a lot as a narrative concept. And there've been a couple places where, Zizek kind of writes that. And I find it really interesting. One of my favorite examples of quilting point in like as a narrative concept is, do you know the comic, the web comic, Garfield minus Garfield?
I do.
Yeah. Okay. If anyone does not, it's exactly what it says on the tin. Is this guy, I'm forgetting his name, he removes Garfield, but it's not just Garfield, anything that has to do with Garfield from Garfield comics. And so you can look at it one of two ways. It either makes the quilting point John, and you see he's just this depressed, lonely guy who never does anything. Like that's like sort of what the I think the tagline on the website is like a lonely everyman fighting a losing battle against like malaise in a quiet suburban America or something like that. So it either gifts it a new quilting point, right? Because we've removed Garfield, because Garfield's the name of the comic, so Garfield is a quilting point. Or I think this is the other way to look at it, is it just shows you what the quilting point of meaning already always was. I just reversed the always already, but like that's the that. And so I like that as a like as an example. So the question, or I suppose the problematic that you raise, is that like where in the clinic, is the patient asking you to be the period at the end of their sentence, you know? Yeah. And that is the, it seems like it's a empowering gesture for the clinician, but it's the one that must be refused. And like, you know, like I was saying about my experience, like I had to, you know, I think my grapple with ordinary psychosis was basically like it was like a run on sentence. And I with it had no period, and my friends helped me like sort of like find that period, like that period of the relation, and that, yeah. I had to do that. Like someone could not have given that to me.
But that's the key element, right? Like you talked yourself into that.
Yeah.
Right. They didn't put the punctuation in. They didn't punctuate. Yeah. Mm-hmm, they allowed for you to do the run on sentence in the way that mm-hmm. you did. And eventually you realized this is a run on sentence.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Now, if somebody would have told you this is a run-on sentence, you'd be like, you just don't understand.
You don't understand. It would have, of course, it would have. Well, it's, yeah. I mean, I think that's wild psychoanalysis, right? Knowledge does not cure the symptom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's like one of the most enduring like lessons in the standard edition. You know, it's like people think they're doing God's work on the internet by shouting down anti-vaxxers, and it's like, you are masturbating. That's what you're doing. Mm, like, yep. Like,
no one's having fun except for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, yes, 100%. You are right. Yes, completely. Yeah. But what you think you're doing and what you are doing, very, very divorced from each other.
That's where you can cut the jouissance away, I think, right?
Yeah,
like that would be a neurosis in certain ways. It's so weird. Like when you were talking about your experience, I was thinking of it both from like the point of view of the structural clinic with, you know, the foreclosure, repression, disavowal stuff. And mm-hmm. from the Borromean, which is where ordinary psychosis and stuff kind of comes from that, mm-hmm. You know, and it was interesting because, you know, clinically, I think there's always something that is important to keep in mind. And that's that people who have a neurotic structure mm-hmm. Can have a psychotic episode.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is that psychotic episode is episodic. It does come to an end and then you return to the neurotic structure. You know, and all that.
So
this is an important thing.
No, Neil. So the neurotic. No, I love this. So because I'm always trying to work this out. I'm teaching a class in seriality, and I try to end right now. And for me, seriality, like I didn't have this answer when I was writing my dissertation, but my the way that I wrote about it was so like what, like I wanted, like I thought it was this like, and I do think that is this. It's a I don't know, a controlling metaphor, if you like, for relation, like as such. And the question that I would like was asked in my defense was that, like, you know, if everything's serial, then like nothing is. Like, how do you respond to that? And like, I had really no response to that. And now my response is, no, everything is serial. We'll park that to one side. The point is, what do we make of the relation within that? Okay. And so I'd like that for the neurotic, like the neuroses is the serial thing, and then the episodic, as in this like this interruption, the self-contained short story, is the like that like psychotic, like anyway, I like that a lot. Like that's that helps me sort of think in another in terms of the clinic, the like how seriality can be like a useful metaphor, which Freud obviously thought it was. As I you know, as I mentioned in studies on hysteria, like the experience of every newspaper reader goes through when they reach the end of their favorite serial story and come upon the words "to be continued." Mm-hmm. And he talks about how he doesn't use the word cliffhanger because people didn't use it when he was writing, but it's the experience of the cliffhanger causes suffering, and his point is that with the analytic session, which is a serial endeavor, like that's the, and it's, again, it's like, this is where like my work is that, like, you know, what is a problem, quote unquote, for psychoanalysis? Well, like a cure, or to put it in other words, an ending. What's a problem for serial narratives? Ending, because you know what you know what a serial narrative has to tell you? Anything can happen. Mm-hmm. That's what a serial, like, while it's happening, is like, we can do anything. And then when it ends, it's like, lies. We could do five things. That's what we could do, because it has to be over. And man, people hate that shit, and they want the last season of Game of Thrones to be rewritten, or the final episode of How I Met Your Mother, or Mass Effect, or do Pokemon again because it didn't have all the characters, or like whatever. Like, people like reject this, and like it plays out a lot. So anyway, just to kind of like to pull it back, the idea of this. The seriality of it to me, and I think this is like a key part of what I find really like it, like, of enduring interest in seriality, is it isn't a refusal of the end, but it asks you to take up a different position relative to it.
That's good stuff. Yeah. It makes me think of I don't know how familiar either of you guys are with this, but there's a thing that can be done within the certain Lacanian schools called a pass. Have you heard of this? Mm-hmm.
No, tell me, like, I'm a baby.
Okay. So after you've been in an analysis for however long, you know, it's not really, there's any time frame for this kind of a thing. You keep on coming to an impasse, this thing that you can't get past, this thing that now you try to go double back, find a new route, but you end up at the same spot again. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And through the process of analysis, you come to realize this, and you start to be implicated in your own role in coming back to this point. And in the enjoyment of that repetition for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in becoming somewhat aware of it through this lived experience of analysis, what ends up happening is you can get past it. You can actually discover a way to transcend the fundamental fantasy and move to something else. I think of that almost as what would happen when one series comes to an end. Like, you, it's done what it needs to do, but the seriality needs to continue. And so now you just need to find a new form of the serial that people can go into until you get to another pass. When somebody performs a pass, they put an end to their analysis.
Yeah.
And there's a technical thing that people do, basically, which I don't want to get into because it's kind of boring. But eventually, if all the technical stuff goes well, you sort of are recognized as somebody who's done this difficult thing, and then you stop being an analysis and you start giving testimony of what happened in your analysis to other people, and you become an analyst of the school. It's a rank, kind of, and you can keep that for 3 years. And when you're in that, it's almost as if, and this is maybe an interesting transition to one of our other topics we wanted to talk about, psychoanalysis in the classroom. You know how Lacan said that when he was doing his seminar, that his audience was his analyst, and that he was the analysand, and he was just talking to them as the analyst, right? It's kind of like that. You start using the school, the members of the school, become this audience for you, and you continue your analysis in this sort of like different way, in a sense. So anyways, it made me think of that when you were going through this.
That's fascinating. Would you, before we go to the classroom, Neil Gorman, would you say that the spinoff functions as pass?
Huh? Would the spinoff function as a pass? I have to think about that. Actually.
So like when I was thinking, like Breaking Bad ends, Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Like that, that's a really nice concrete, sorry, I snapped. That's bad for microphones. But like the, you know, we have this series and I think this is like pretty significant. No one ever talks about the ending to Breaking Bad, because it was like it did what it was supposed to do. It was like very appropriate. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like Sopranos with the trauma of making people think their cable went out and then making them put together what might have occurred with no, you know, chance of like it being, you know, firmly like confirmed, or anything else. Like it was a very appropriate ending, a definitive ending. And then Better Call Saul, and now the El Camino is a film that the character Jesse Pinkman's in for Netflix, right? So it keeps going. It's like I like to think about this too with like the Marvel films, where you get like there's like four endings of these movies. There's an ending to the movie, then there's like a mid credits ending. And then there's the end of credits ending. And then there's like, maybe if you stick around while the people are cleaning up all the disgusting like Coke that's on the floor and whatever, like the popcorn, there's like another little like teaser kind of thing. So it's like you have to keep, I,
I wonder. I don't know that it is. Yeah. I think it would have to be more like a Walter's story would have to continue in a different way, but I think for it to be a pass as opposed to it picking up the somebody else.
Somebody else. Well, it does. So doesn't. Yeah. Like it. Yeah. I don't not to, to not get into the nitty gritty of it, but like because Better Call Saul is the prequel. You know what I mean? Like it is going to pick up Walter's story, but from another angle. Do you know what I mean? But yeah. I don't. But whatever. That's just. I think. I had never thought about that. Like when you, I guess this is just the whole point is that like when to think of like of narrative, like to really be like rigorous and insistent on the psychoanalytic like currency to it, to think of like everything in terms of psychoanalysis, like it's just interesting. I never thought of like spinoff as past, like, and you know, you had to explain the idea to me, but that just like, that just popped. Okay. Audience.
Yeah.
So and classroom.
And this is where I was going to start off with. It's a question for you, Jared, right? Because like you're probably the one out of the three of us who's been through this the most recently. You know, regardless of where we all are currently, we all went through the process of being students, right? We were students in classrooms of various types throughout our lives. Some of us for a very long time, you know, and to accrued a ton of debt to be a student and all of that. So, and it's interesting now I'm on the other side of that. I'm a professor. Ryan, you're on the other side of that right now. You're a professor. And I find this to be really fascinating because, like there's a thing that another analyst whose work I respect and admire a great deal. Her name is Maria Cristina Aguilera. She recently said, in a talk she was giving about psychoanalysis that as psychoanalysts, we should always remember that we were analysands first. We were always analysands first. And I think about how as a professor, it's important to remember that you were a student first. I don't know that all professors or all teachers do that, but you know, that's interesting. And then that reminded me of the thing that Lacan said about how when he teaches, he gave his seminar, the audience was the analyst for him. And it made me reflect on my own experience as a teacher. So now there'll be times even teaching Zoom school. And before I was teaching Zoom school, when I was in a regular classroom, I'd be teaching, I'd be speaking, you know, trying to make go on and on about a thing, an idea or whatever. And then, you know, I'd get to a point where like, I was like, I'd stop and I'd look and I'd expect like hands to be shooting up with people having things to say about my wonderful, you know, articulation of whatever that was. And it's just quiet. It's dead quiet. There's nothing going on. It's just like a lot of faces going like, I'm thinking about that. Huh? Let me take, you know, and I didn't know it until recently that that's what it feels like to be in analysis. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm still in analysis. I go talk to an analyst on a regular basis a couple times a week. And, that happens in analysis. I'll say something and I feel like I've said something important or significant. And then the analyst just kind of goes, huh? You know, and all that. So I just kind of wanted to describe this experience because I've only recently started to think of it that way. And it's been really interesting for me to think of my students as my analyst and I'm just an analysand free associating, trying to work stuff out. And they're just there like being the dupe, the one like rejecting the being the other, not being the one who knows and they're doing a remarkably good job. It's fascinating. So I guess wanted to describe that to each of you and see what your take on that was. Jared, why don't you get us going on that?
Well, I think that first of all, there's a very, at least part of it is a very practical reason. We talked a little bit about this before the show and we've talked about this before on several different episodes where in the United States, talking about psychoanalysis in general and Freud or Lacan in particular aren't like really popular. Like it's kind of scandalous, I guess. I can't think of a better word off the top of my head to talk about especially Freud in the classroom, where you know the program that you teach is much more mired in those evidence-based practices, like all the acronyms for therapy that there are. And I've often thought when I was sitting in your classrooms before that people weren't always, certainly there were some students that were super into it, me being one of them. but there were a lot of students who were just not interested in talking about Freud at all. They were like, that dude was a weird pervert and we've moved on from Freud and now we've got CBT or Eric Erickson or whoever else it is that didn't have weird sexual components to their
that we know
theories.
Of.
Yeah. That's very true. I don't know that much about Eric Erickson other than his eight stages or whatever they were. So who knows? Maybe there was a sketchy past to his theory. But
eight's a weird number. Why? Maybe the nine was the sex one. He was like, I can't do that.
I can't publish that. I don't want to turn into the Freud of the of the Eric Erickson world.
He was ego psychologist. He was the enemy.
Yeah. That's true. But so all I was saying is that I think there's at least part of it is a very practical reason that Freud has been kind of condemned in a lot of ways in the United States therapeutic discourse. Certainly not everywhere and not for everyone, but very commonly.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's there's a thing I've been saying this to my classes. This will probably resonate with you, Neil, and I'm sure Jared, did you take any Zoom classes? Does this happen, or you're mm-hmm. done? Okay, all right. Well, what I what I think has to be done to teach at Zoom University, no matter where you are, is you have to acknowledge that if you turn the brightness off on your screen, you're just yelling at your computer. Like that's what's happening. Like if we all did this right now, we're just yelling at our computers. And I started my classes this semester with that acknowledgement. And because it's, I don't know, like Neil, that experience that you described of like, you know, you think you made this great point and then there's like, you don't have the validation or, you know, like or from the class, or it's like, or it's muted, or it's a different kind of energy. I often think like stand-up comics should teach. Because I've seen a lot of like young stand-up comics, and when they tell jokes and they've done three in a row and the audience has laughed at all of them, and they get to fourth one and people just like, you just can't laugh that much. And then it doesn't hit. They're just like, oh, you didn't like that one. And it's like, dude, just chill out for a second. Go teach for like a week. If you bomb in front of those people, you got to see those motherfuckers again, like the next day. You got to get back in there with an audience. They're just in and out. It's just different folks. It's like so teaching is this I really think that it teaches you how to relate to your own castration like a lot of the time, and that like really it is not about you. It has to be, and I think in a meaningful way it's like to go along with that, like the Lacan part. I do actually think that like popular pedagogy, not in a Lacanian way, but has embraced this idea that like the, you know, you're the analyst, right? Like I'm the analyzer, because it's, what is it? The popular phrase is like student-centered pedagogy is it like, I don't know anyone who wouldn't claim to do that, whether the people actually do that. But the point is not like, you cannot be invested in yourself as Quilting Point, as like, you know, as big A, right? Like I heard someone put this, put it one way that like you have to do the class in a way that makes you irrelevant. I don't think that's possible. I don't think you can ever become irrelevant, but I think what you do is like you make the class irrelevant in the sense that you bring students to a place where they've learned from the class and then they have to go beyond it to like to continue. And that's like always like my idea of like the final project. The final project should be you going beyond that which you have learned so far. Do not recapitulate everything that we've done, because like I've read all the things. That's why I assigned them and talked about them yelling at my computer screen, because I know how to talk about them. I want you to tell me something new about it. So you eviscerate the class to like, in a sense, to make the class sort of meaningful. And that's a mantle that I think it's hard to take up in the classroom. And like when students do take it up, it's like Jared, like it sounds like you did, like it's like that's, it's like life-giving, you know, like to a professor, like you want to see that. But it's
that's weird though, Ryan, because it was terrible. Yeah. It wasn't life-giving. That was the thing. going to analysis is awful. I don't know if people get this, okay, because you go in and You spill, you know, your your life and your description of terrible things that you've thought and fantasies you've had and things that you've done, and more other gross stuff. And this person's reaction is like a non-reaction. It's you know that they're listening to you. That's clear. Mm-hmm. Like they're paying attention, and you know that they are paying attention, but they're not reacting to you, mm-hmm. right? They're just kind of like, yeah, go on. Continue.
But doesn't that have to be the thing? I think that that has to be the you know, it's sort of like I was talking with some psychoanalytically inclined people, like about my cat, who I have to take to the vet, like after I was talking, and I was saying that like my cat has taught me a lot about objet a, because whenever we get her a toy, she plays with the box. And then the person pointed out, like, hate to be a stickler, but that just changes where objet a is, right? Like, and so anyway, so like, so you saying that, like I think the life-giving, like life-affirming, like moments of analysis are exactly what you described. It's sure. not the, yeah. It's not the, like, it's not the student shooting their hand up. It's actually the, like,
oh yeah, yeah. That's a good way to look at it. I like that. Yeah. But it that was the difference though, where like I recognize now faster, I guess I still do it, but I recognize that I'm like trying to get the students to like me. I'm trying to.
I started with this as my big problem. I keep talking about that.
Yeah, I'm like, I want them to think that I'm something, or think something about me, you know, or whatever. And so I'm presenting to them, and in that sense, what I've done is I've cast them in the role of the big O other, and I'm looking for it to like validate me. And say like, yeah, you're a good professor. You're a smart guy. You know things about Lacan. You know, you're on the right track. Thanks so much for enlightening us. Now we're better, or something like that. And instead I get, how many pages does this need to be?
Yeah.
or something. And I'm like, you know, but
Neil, it's so funny. I had I went through the same thing, man. Like when I first started teaching, it's a problem. It's a thing that I working on as a person, where like I I'm not sure what movie this is from, but like I was very obsessed when I was younger for making sure everybody, even people I particularly did not care for, that they liked me. Mm-hmm. Like that was like I needed that to be boxed off, so I didn't have to worry about it. And I felt like in my personal life, I had done like a pretty good job of like moving past that a little bit. But when I started teaching, it came roaring back, and I needed the class to like me to know I was doing a good job. And I had to, for me, it was, and I'm sure you like come across the same thing, that like there's a, you come across an impasse where if what you are invested in is the students liking you, then like that like brings the value of the class down. And like, so I was getting as a graduate student, I was getting these evaluations that like for a year I thought were good. And then I started to think about them in a different way, where like I was evaluated very well, but the class was not always evaluated very well. And I thought, and part of it was I wasn't making it. I was like, so there was literally a split between me and the class. Like I was, cause when you're a graduate student, you're trusted to teach a class, but like to a point, because you know you're given all the assignments and there's a structure and you have to like kind of play within it and adhere to it. It was a composition class, so there was reason for the class to be evaluated separate from me. But that was when I was a master's student, but it really took until I was a PhD student where I. And it was something that my partner, Kara, said to me, which she just said, like, you kind of have to take yourself seriously a little bit, like, and that, like, you actually have something to say to them. And that's really the difference. Cause same thing, Neil. Yeah.
Yeah. That you take yourself seriously, which is the difference, I think. Right. So like when I teach now, like if I have something interesting that I'm trying to work out, you know, it's not usually the stuff that I've like, you know, there's some things I can speak on with a relative amount of like, I've read about this, I've thought about this, I've written mm-hmm. about that. Like I've done a lot of work on it. There's a mm-hmm. lot of other stuff, which is kind of like, yeah, like I'm kind of thinking this through right now and I'm kind of at this place and this is kind of my process and where I've gone through and where I think I'm going in that direction. when I'm teaching in that direction, people are actually riveted. You know, and because I'm not in that instance, I'm truly, I think, just kind of talking people through, my narrative, you know, like this is my thing. And, I'm not attempting to get them to like or dislike that, you know, it's not about that. It's just more about explaining this thing. And incidentally, that actually leads to what seems to be a better experience for everybody. And when I slide back into that, kind of hysterical, neurotic position of like wanting to be admired, what ends up happening to me is that the way that I teach, I think, comes across that way, and it's rather off-putting to the people who are unfortunately subjected to it. You know,
Like or just like I am. It's I had to start saying this at the start of my classes because I had this when you teach like film, when you teach film classes in particular, sometimes students can take it. And, this happened when I was at University of Rhode Island that like the point is we are,
didn't the Talking Heads go to that university?
I don't think, no, they went to RISD. They went to Rhode Island School of Design. Yeah. No. Yeah. No
street cred for me.
No street. No, it's okay. But that song, I think, what is it? That line, do I smell home cooking? It's only the river. It's only the river. That's about Providence. It has a unique smell. I'll say that. I don't know what I would say is as attractive as perhaps the line in the Talking Heads song makes it out to be. But yeah. But when I was teaching URI, the first film class that I taught, like it was clear to me that a number of students thought that the point was that we're going to learn how to ruthlessly articulate what is a good movie and what is a bad movie. And that is not it at all. And so like what I had to kind of come to is that like, look, I don't care if you like anything that on the semester, it's not the point. I hope that you do. It'd be great if you did, but I don't care if you like any of it. The like, what can we say about it? Like what does this do? And that's like this like, you know, this thing that I took from the composition class where like you try to move students from is to does. That's like that's the way that they put it. And that's how I try to move from like, we move away from evaluation and we move toward analysis as I call it in the classroom. And that's been helpful for me.
As you say that, and Jared, we talked about this, I think, two episodes back. So maybe you have something about this too. I don't know if you will, but the way you're talking about films and the way that you engage those films reminds me of the way that the analyst engages the dream in dream work.
I mean, 1895, the film begins at the same time that the psychoanalysis does. It's like, you can't make it up. And 100%.
It's not about like, this was a good dream or a bad dream.
What would be the point of that? It's like, that sounds like if you went to analysis and that was what the analyst said, like, that's a good dream. I think that's two thumbs up.
You should have it again.
You're going to do a sequel?
Yeah. Do a flying one again. Yeah.
Good. And when Jared and I have talked about this, I mean, that's dream work is something that I teach about in clinical classes. And I haven't been prevented from doing that yet. Maybe one day I will be, but, I'll do this.
Perish the thought.
Yeah, actually. But here's the thing. Like I've changed how I do it. What I used to do is I would say to students like, hey, if I have no takers, then I have no takers and it's not a big deal. We'll just not do this. But if there's anybody who's willing to talk about a dream in front of a classroom, I can give you a taste of what dream work would look like. I'm not going to like do it like really in depth or anything. It's just to kind of illustrate it a bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, different people would come and I'd get volunteers usually, and they'd tell me a dream. And then what I would do is I'd illustrate different ways of doing dream work. One is tell me the same dream again from start to finish with as much detail as you can. Don't leave anything out. And then people inevitably add things and subtract things. And then I start there and I'm like, you in the first telling you mentioned this and it wasn't there before. What else comes to mind when you think of that? Now we're not even talking about the dream. It's like what comes to mind when you think about that thing from the dream. And this starts off this process of the signifying chain, right? This leads to this, leads to this. And eventually you come to something where people have a hard time talking and that's a bit of repression. You know, and that's usually where I would kind of be like, okay, so if I was doing this for real, this would be where I'd start to have to do this kind of a thing. But I don't want to like pry into people's personal lives in that format.
In front of everybody. Yeah.
You know, and it turns out that, you know, I think that there's been just a general like, hey, kind of watch out about asking students to, because you got to be aware of the power dynamic and things like that. Yeah. And I hear that and I understand it. And I'm so like, now what I'll do is I talk to people who I know who are not my students, and I ask them to tell me a dream, and I record it as a podcast, and then I put it up on our classes. We use Moodle as our learning system. So that's the way I do it. And that was all a stupid way of describing that what you said about film is the same way that I think about dreams.
Well, no, it's actually very similar. As far as I know, there's not a lot of psychoanalytically inclined people who do like a rhetoric and composition. There is one guy, his name's T.R. Johnson, and he has actually a pretty interesting
book.
Oh, about the four discourses.
You read Pedagogy. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Loved that book.
It's super. That book is great. Yeah. He had this essay that I read, when I was in my master's program, that it called School Sucks. I don't know if you've ever read it.
I haven't. No,
it's pretty good. And what he talks about is, it's a nice like intro to thinking about composition and psychoanalysis, because what he says is that the American model of education does nothing so well as turn writers into masochists, that the only pleasure in writing an essay is when it's done. And that made like a huge impact on me. And then I later found out he wrote that book, and I thought that was really great. And this was before I'd like, this is before I'd even like taken my class with Todd and then gone on my trajectory that has led me here. But it's just interesting that that's the way that's your approach with the dream work. Because that just is a writing exercise, is like you ask students to do. It's just so funny to me that like these, it's just made up that there is a schism between doing things psychoanalytically in the classroom and like doing them like in a way that is like justified and legitimated by the majority. Because a classic exercise in a writing in a composition classroom is to ask students to write a memoir, and then you ask them to write it again, and then you ask them to do it from a different point, or you say like, okay, that's where you ended, start there. You know, and just like all of these, like it's just, I don't know. To me, there are a lot of things that end up in like film and media studies, and then I think like this is a good example where there is an unacknowledged analytic bent to it that, if explored, could be like, you know, it could be. I mean, it just could be profitable for all the discourses that are, and I don't mean that in the four discourse way, but I just mean like the rhetoric and composition discourse of the classroom, discourse student, like that kind of thing. And it's just usually refused. So I don't know. Anyway, I don't know how we fix that. We just keep doing stuff like this, I guess.
Maybe, yeah. Jared, what were you going to say? I it looked like you were going to talk. I can't tell if I'm reading your face correctly here or not.
I was not.
Oh, okay. Huh. Sorry.
No, this is great. That's just like the classroom when you think someone raised their hand, but they're touching their hair. That's my favorite thing. I screw that up all the time. Uh-huh. And I screw it up in Zoom University. But it makes me feel like I'm in the classroom. And that's all that I really wanted this semester, is to feel like I was in the classroom, like at least a couple times. And usually it's when I fuck up. So that's been pretty good.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that happens. It's funny. Like I try to recover from that sometimes where like, you know, I was just stretching or something.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
and you should, you got to say you were doing it too.
I'm like, oh, cool. Like, yeah, you know, classroom yoga is a good thing.
Yeah. Right. You got
to
stay.
I'll adopt it. Yeah, or try to make it funny. And stuff. That's just, I'm trying to get them to like me, I guess, again. This has nothing to do with anything, but I think it's a funny story, so I'm going to tell it. When I was in college, there was this guy, and he was one of the most naturally funny people I knew. And part of what made him naturally funny is that I don't think he thought he was very funny at all. Like he was extremely self-deprecating, and not in a way that I would describe as like the way that people can do it on purpose, right? Like he was naturally this kind of like aw shucksy dude. And one day I was at a party, and there was a sliding glass door, and he had, you know, like a cup of alcohol, and he went to go outside, and he walked right into the glass door, like right into it, boom, you know, and stuff. and everybody stops, of course, and looks at what's happened. And without missing a beat, this dude goes, "And for my next trick," and then he opened the door and left. And it was like, that is so good. You know, and that's like, I wish I could be that funny.
Man, yeah, that's good. Well, so I think it's very relevant, because it's what is crucial in the, is the relation to the, like, if that's the relation to the trauma, like that's a lowercase t social trauma, but like it really, like, that's like that for like many folks, like, my god, like how I think Alison Bechdel has this really nice phrase from one of the comics that she did about Insomnia Jeopardy, that like you know when you're having a hard time going to sleep, and it's like ex-lovers for 1,000, things I wish I said but didn't for 200, things I said but didn't, but really wish I hadn't, you know, like for four, like you go through the whole thing. And it's like, you know, that person immediately found the, again, I snapped on the mic. That's bad news. He immediately found like the proper, like social relation to that traumatic event. And that's, yeah, that's real skill. Mm-hmm. That's very, very much real skill.
Yeah. It was amazing. To me, it's funny. You were talking about snapping. I don't know if you guys can hear this or not. My email notifications, which I thought were turned off, are not turned off. So every time an email comes through, there's the sound that listeners are unfortunately.
I have not been hearing it. So I hope that your listeners haven't heard it or will not hear it. But
they probably will. But you know, whatever. It shows us that we're not made up. Okay, we couldn't imagine that.
We do have real jobs. Yeah, I'm not making this up. You're getting real emails, and I'm not sending them to you. So that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So, anyways, like just kind of like thinking of where we are time wise, and knowing that we all have other things that we'll need to get to here. I was gonna kind of like move into an last area here, but before we do, does anybody else have anything that they wanted to kind of like throw into the mix about psychoanalysis in the classroom?
Nah, let's go on, Neil.
All right, cool.
Let's do it.
So I was going to, you brought up the T.R. Johnson book, and that's, I wasn't thinking of this until you did that, but I thought one of the things that might be interesting, we don't do this on our podcast a lot. I don't think we've ever done it. No, I shouldn't say we don't do it a lot. We just don't do it. So let's start. What are some things that people who are interested in this stuff might enjoy either watching or reading or listening to or something like that? I just kind of figured we could all go around and on Why Theory, which is such a great podcast. Anybody who listens to this probably listens to that already, but if you don't, you should. At the end of that podcast, Ryan and Todd talk about the lesson. And a lot of times the lesson is watch some kind of a film. And so I think I'm trying to do a different riff on that.
Yeah, no, you should. And I think, like, I imagine people, like, if you haven't listened to the show, like, the almost, for Todd, the lesson of everything is to watch Heathers. Like, mm-hmm. He really thinks that's the most, it's not a bit, like, and I think he's right, but this is the most pedagogical film. He taught it he did I missed this by just a semester, but he did a class on Hegel in the teen film, and mm-hmm. like, that was a prominent. So, yeah, so Heathers is always Todd's example, but start with Jared, and I'll come around with another one.
All right, Jared, what do you think? We've been talking about psychoanalysis in classrooms and ordinary psychosis. It could be those or something else. What's something that people should be reading or watching or listening to?
You know, the thing that's probably the most on my mind right now, because I just finished watching it for the first time in several years, is BoJack Horseman.
Hell yeah.
I watched that show when the first season was out, and then I didn't watch it again forever. So, like, I think last week I finished watching all of the 6 seasons that are currently out. You know, when I was watching it, I wasn't thinking so much about psychosis, but I was thinking a lot about repetition compulsion, death drive, symptoms, some different things like that. I mean, you can watch BoJack Horseman go through the same exact motions without recognizing that he's going through the same exact motions. And then even when he does recognize that he's doing it, when he's going through the same patterns of being, he can't do anything about it. Or at least it feels like he can't do anything about it to him. It feels like something that's happening to him, not something that he's actively taking part in. So, you know, I wasn't watching the show in order to think about its relation to psychoanalysis, but it feels much more difficult to watch anything without trying to relate it to psychoanalysis anymore. And so that was coming up a lot for me as I rewatched BoJack Horseman.
Huh.
Such a good show. It is.
It's excellent. Yeah. That's one of the best bottle episodes too. Fish Out of Water season 3.
I loved it. I loved it. That was such a good one.
Incredible. Yeah. That's incredible. So I mentioned two films to describe my ordinary psychosis, and so I'll just restate them. It's Jacob's Ladder and 1408, both horror films. But I want to mention about to come back to the teaching situation and also stand up. Richard Pryor has a stand up special. I think it's just called Richard Pryor Stand Up, and it's from 81 maybe, and you can watch it on the disreputable version of YouTube. What's it called? Hold on.
That would be a great website right there. Somebody's going to be registering at the disreputable version of YouTube.com.
Hold on. Yeah. What is it? It's I got to click on the link and I'll be able to find it. Oh, Daily Motion. Daily Motion is the disreputable YouTube. They sometimes have things that would, for copyright reasons, need to be taken down. But yeah. So what's pretty fascinating to watch, obviously, Richard Pryor is just like, it's just very funny and it's good to watch. But what he does, and I think this is, it's psychoanalytic, but I think from a different, and an analyst would never do this, but I think like he doesn't start his shows. There's like three different ones. He doesn't start with telling jokes. He doesn't start with, and he starts with crowd work, which most comics don't really do. They like to make this like split, because it's a rhetorical thing, but there's this split between the performer and the audience, and there's a limit to being involved, and you have to, but what Pryor does, and it's really fascinating, is he engages the crowd. He starts talking to them. He starts looking around at like where he is. Like, is there anything weird about where he's at? Is there like there's a background? This is strange. Like what is the, like, he goes through this whole thing and he hasn't told a joke yet. He hasn't told a story. He's just alienated people from the space in which they are in and from where they are. And what he does is he does this to like fuse him as performer and the audience as being a part of the same symbolic situation. And it's like, it's masterful. I mean, if he was alive, he wouldn't say that's what he did, but that's what he does. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's really, really like, it's really great. Like I think like divests himself as like stand-up performer. Cause as I said, he's not telling a joke. He's just like saying things. He's going around the room. He's talking to people. He's inviting the strangeness of the situation into what he's doing. And then after he has sufficiently done that, then he starts to tell stories and do stand up. It's like, it's fascinating. Wow. And yeah.
That, you know, as you say that, I mean, this is, I'm just thinking this right this second. So this is super raw, but, that reminds me of like, so in psychoanalysis now where there's this idea that it needs to change, right? The clinic that Freud created in Vienna prior to World War II was a clinic that was suited to people who were living in that time in that place and dealing with the very stable name of the father and big other and things like that. It was structured on neurotics. Lacan, you know, who I don't know if he said this or not, but or somebody else just said this about him, he could see the exit from Freud's clinic where he was, and he was working in a different place, and he created the first clinic, the structural clinic. And then there was this idea that after May 68, there's the creation of yet another clinic. And this is what Miller and the Lacanian schools are trying to continue, you know, today, is the construction and working through of the later Lacan, the last stuff he was doing towards the end, and really trying to run with it. And one of the things they talk about is that we don't talk about the unconscious in the same way anymore. Now we talk about the body, the speaking body. And what you're talking about with Pryor is he turns this into a body event.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Absolutely.
You know, and that's such an interesting way to illustrate that concept, right? It's the body is going through something. The body is experiencing a thing, and it's strange and weird, and then it speaks, you know, as a result of it. So that's really interesting to me.
That's really great, Neil, because I should mention where I was. So I assigned the prior stand-up in the my seriality class because I read Kathy Park Hong talk about it. She's a wonderful poet, but she has this recent memoir that I want to maybe just also put out. It's called Minor Feelings, subtitled An Asian American Reckoning. And she talks about she had this – it actually begins with her – she's Korean, and she was trying to connect with – a Korean therapist who refused her, and she felt like, so she tells this story of like hounding this woman basically to try to like get her to like confirm her, and it's her, and so it begins with like she starts talking like very very open about this like break that she had with and also how she started to like get like better was to watch Richard Pryor. And so she stopped when she was asked to do poetry readings, and she stopped doing poetry readings. She started doing stand up, and like it was awkward and weird, but it gave her, I like not to like to read her back to her, but she does say this like it gave her a different way to relate to like to herself, and that helped her move through. But she talks about how bodily his performance are. So I think like you're without having seen it, like you're totally on that. Mm. And anyway, so like so Minor Feelings, excellent book. Richard Pryor and 1408 and Jacob's Ladder. Those are my four recommendations.
Yeah, so I have two that I think are good. So the first one comes from what you just said here. It's there's a poet named Anne Carson.
Oh yeah.
And she's also a classicist. She translates things from ancient Greek into modern English and stuff. Anything she does is magic. Everybody should just like consume all of it, I think, right? She's incredible.
If you go Autobiography of Red, is that the one you're going to go with?
Yes. That's a good one, you know. She's awesome. If you just go to YouTube and type her in Anne Carson, Carson, you'll find her reading her stuff. That's a good introduction. It'll give you a taste of it. So that's amazing. But the film I wanted to recommend is a great film, I think, for psychoanalysis. And, the name of the film, it's a French film. I don't remember when it was made. I want to say it was like late 90s, possibly early 2000s, but I don't know exactly when. It's called Intimate Strangers.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you the premise of this film here. There's a guy who's an accountant, and he has an office, and across the way from him is a psychoanalyst. And one day a woman shows up, and she gets into the building, and the accountant is like this guy who's filled with ennui. He has all these philosophy books on his bookshelf because he doesn't really want to be an accountant, but that's what he's doing. This woman's trying to go to the psychoanalyst, but she makes a wrong turn and goes into his office, the accountant's office. And she's like, I'm here for an appointment. And he's like, oh, I must have forgotten that I booked somebody. So he's like, oh, please sit down. and he sits down and he goes, and he doesn't know why she's there. Right.
Yeah.
So he's like, what brings you in? And she's like, well, here's the deal. And she starts to talk about how her she's in this romantic relationship, which is going terribly wrong for these reasons. And mm-hmm. it's all this very personal stuff kind of just starts spilling out of her. And the accountant recognizes what's happening, and he keeps on trying to like interject to tell her that she's in the wrong spot, but she keeps on talking and he never gets the chance. And then she just goes, oh my gosh, I can't believe I've just told all this to a complete stranger. And she leaves. And he's like, oh, this is interesting. Weird, you know? And like the analyst like walks by at that point and like looks in his room and he's just going, you know, like, I don't know. Then she comes back and he's actually interested in her story. And so he just kind of like, he does the analyst thing, actually. He's like, mm-hmm. Tell me, go on, you know, tell me more, you know, and he doesn't know what to say. So he's quiet. And then she keeps on talking, you know, and it was interesting because it shows, and other things happen in this film too, but I'm just kind of giving you the initial setup here.
The broad strokes.
You know, but I think what's so interesting about it is that it does show that somebody who doesn't go through, you know, psychoanalytic training can actually enact the discourse of the analyst. That is a possibility, whether you're a professor or you're cutting hair or you just are, you're an Uber driver. I don't know, like any number of things could do this. And I think that that's a really important thing for people to see, because sometimes they think that being an analyst is like this, like very kind of like super secret. You have to go to the place when the Saturn is in line with the moon and Mercury's in retrograde and, you know, pray to Freud or something, you know, for 7 years in analysis. And I don't think it's that hard, right? Like, And learning and reading and all that stuff is great. People should do it. But, people authorize themselves to be analysts. This is one of Lacan's great points in all of the things that he does. And then, of course, the community can confirm or deny that authorization. But this is something that happens. And what is really necessary, I think, to be a good analyst or to be a good professor is the ability to, speak freely and to listen with evenly suspended attention. Ultimately. And I think that film's a good example of that. So that was my takeaway.
It's fantastic. Like, I mean, I think that is a good example. And I think that your examples too, of teachers, like Uber drivers, like hairdressers, like as well, that like there is something that is so, psychoanalysis hooks into something that is so primary and so available across a swath of experience and education and background, and it is in a Hegelian way, right? You would say that it's virtue and also the flaw, because it's the thing that makes it it's the thing that is I like the absolute best thing about it, but it is also the thing that makes it seem like, oh, it's not so that's not a specialist thing at all if a hairdresser can do it. It's like, no, you've missed the point. There are specialists in it, but we have a almost an a priori shared understanding of how and why it works. And that is the most important thing about it. And the thing that, general awareness of would be, it would be nice.
Yeah. Because I mean, it's, you've said this on Y Theory a couple of times, cure is a bonus. And it does. It comes from this engaging in this very odd process that it's unreckless. No one else will have the same experience you do. It'll be your experience of analysis, and that's what it is. And if it has the right effect, then you keep coming until you don't want to or don't need to, I guess, and you're done. And if you find that there's still something that you're getting from it, then you keep showing up, and that's just kind of how it works. So, anyways, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah,
I really appreciate this.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on. This is so great. I'm going to go take my cat to the vet. So not a euphemism. I'm really going to go do that. Thanks so much, Jared. Thanks.
That's
thanks
what you would so say much. If it was a euphemism.
I would say that, exactly. Right. Yeah, so how would
it's
you
a
know?
Cover. It's a lure.
Right. It is. Neil, Jared, thank you so much, guys.
Yeah, thank you too, Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan.
Take care.
Yeah.